Hi, Amy. Again, this is George Wall from the FCIC. I'm joined with my colleague, Jeff Smith. And just for the record, you are consenting to this call being recorded, correct?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'm going to give you the standard speech that we give everyone about the FCIC. I'll keep it brief. We were a commission that was created out of the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. It is a bipartisan commission that's looking into the causes of the financial crisis. And one of those items, actually it's 22 specific items, and the first one on the list is abuse and fraud in the mortgage market. And that's why we want to talk to you today. It's concerning your experiences at BB&T as it relates to mortgage fraud and mortgage abuse. By way of background, I don't know if John told you, I'm a Secret Service agent who's detailed to the commission right now. I have some experience in mortgage fraud, and my colleague, Jeff Smith, is an attorney who's permanent staff here at the council, and he's got loads more of legal experience than I ever will. But if at any point in time during the questioning you have any questions for us, please let us know. Don't feel free to stop us and interject. Before we get started, is there any questions or any issues that you want to work out?
I don't think so.
Okay. John, anything on your end?
No, there's nothing for me.
Okay, great. Amy, if we could get started, first of all, how do you pronounce your last name?
Strap, S-T-R-O-U-P-E. It's like the O-U is like a ah sound.
Okay. And if we could get a brief educational and professional background, starting with, I guess, after high school.
Oh, my. I see. Well, after high school, I went to work at a textile plant locally here in Cleveland County and worked there for 3 years. I was married during that time and left there, went to work for a tack shop for maybe a couple months. Then I went to PPG and worked there for a year and a half.
What's PPG?
It's a fiberglass manufacturing plant.
Oh, okay.
And it was really hard because we worked rotating shifts, seven days on third, 7 days on second, and 7 days on first, and you'd get a 4 day break. So
right.
I was, exhausted all the time and decided that, this wasn't for me and I needed to go back to school. So I went back to the mill that I had worked at 3 years prior and enrolled in school and got an associate's degree in criminal justice.
Where at?
At Cleveland Community College.
And what year did you get your AA?
That was in 96.
You said that was, Cleveland Community College?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll see. Then I continued to work at the mill. I was pregnant during the time that I worked and went to school, so there at the end, I ended up graduating, and I was pregnant at that time, and I ended up having my first child. Then left the mill and went to work for the North Carolina Department of Corrections and worked there for 3 years.
When did you start working with the DOC?
In 97.
Through 2000?
2000, yes.
Okay.
And worked there and at the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office part-time in their control room there at the end of my employment at the DSC. I worked for the Sheriff's Office part-time and then ended up...
Now, when you were at the DOC, were you just a corrections officer?
I was a food service manager. I managed the kitchen. I had 12 inmates that worked for me and three officers.
Okay.
I left there and went to the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office. as a deputy. I was sworn in, and then they sponsored me to go through my basic law enforcement training.
And this is the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office?
Yes.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Continue.
I worked for the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office. I was eventually promoted to detective. I guess if you'd call that promotion, I see it more as just a transfer, I guess. A lot of people consider it a promotion, I guess.
When were you transferred to being a detective?
I think that was in 2003.
Okay.
And now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now, as a detective, and the reason I'm interjecting is so we don't have to come back to this later. As a detective, I mean, did you have a specific area? Like, were you strictly like a homicide investigator or robbery, or was it just all crimes that came across your desk?
I worked any investigation for the northern part of Cleveland County. Whether it was a murder, rape. We had somebody that worked specifically child abuse and sex crimes, but oftentimes we'd still have to pick up some of those cases. Paper crimes, property crimes, just anything that happened in the northern part of Cleveland County was assigned to me.
So is this kind of like a general detective bureau?
Yes.
Okay. Now, did you have – I know departments that have that kind of setup generally funnel some things to one detective, some things to another. Was there any one specific area that cases got funneled to you for, or were you just kind of all over the place with the various cases?
I just got any kind of case, any kind of various case. But like I say, we did have somebody that worked. She worked specifically sex crimes or crimes related to children. And then we did have somebody that worked paper crimes, but I guess oftentimes we still had to work some of those occasionally.
Right. How much experience did you get working white-collar stuff when you were at the detective?
Very little, really. Maybe just like, I don't know, check cases or primarily check cases and maybe an occasional credit card fraud or something like that.
How extensive were these cases?
They were usually – I found most paper crimes were fairly easy to track down. And
I mean, what kind of dollar loss are we talking? Are we talking less than $10,000, more than
$10,000? The largest case that I can remember working was $18,000.
Now, was that like a credit card case?
That was a insurance / check fraud.
Okay. About approximately how many white collar cases did you work?
Like I say, it just wasn't very many. The majority of the cases I worked were property crimes or break-ins and things related to that.
Right.
I couldn't give you. I would say less than probably 50.
Okay. So you became a detective in 2003. What happened after that?
I just continued to work for the sheriff's office and making the transition to BB&T. I actually worked a couple of cases for BB&T and was contacted by Dan Hill, who worked for BB&T and was in the Charlotte metro region, to follow up on some things that he had, which one of them was actually an assault case. It wasn't even if one of their employees had been assaulted, it wasn't even a paper crime. And then the next case that I worked for them was an embezzlement case. So I was contacted by BB&T and worked a couple of those. Then in 2005, I was called by Dan Hill and told that there was a position open in Charlotte Metro Region and that he thought that maybe I should put in for it because he remembered me being very prompt in doing follow-ups and getting back in touch with them and getting my cases resolved and things like that. So he suggested that I apply with BB&T. I did, and I got the job.
Now, what was that specific position?
It's called a corporate investigator.
Now, when Dan Hill recruited you for that position, what was explained to you about that position? What were your duties day-to-day and overall?
That it would probably be, you know, the work would probably be similar, you know, as far as investigating the crimes with BB&T would be similar to what we did at the, because I was concerned about just sitting behind a desk all day and being in an office, and he's like, no, you go out and you actually do a lot of work in the field, and you go out and interview people, and, you know, you have a lot of contact with other law enforcement agencies, and you go out and meet them and turn your cases over to other law enforcement agencies, and it sounded like something that I would be interested in.
What was your pay going to be more or less than you were making as a detective?
More. I think it was going to be about a $17,000 pay increase per year for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amy, what was your salary at that time?
At the sheriff's office?
Yes.
I think it was around $29,000, something around there, I think.
Okay, and then they were going.
I can't remember exactly what it was. Go ahead.
And I'm sorry, and they were going to increase your salary to what amount?
It was, I think it was 46.5.
So you believe you're basically going to be doing a similar job for more pay?
Sure, yeah, yeah. It was the way he described it, that he said that there were, you know, a lot of, regulations and things like that I would have to learn, you know, through banking.
Right.
Certain regulations, but he said, you know, it's no big deal, and he sort of went through and described how, you know, because I wasn't even familiar with SARS or that. Oh, hold on, I got another call coming in. Hold on a second. Okay, I'm sorry. It's my husband. I'm not going to answer it.
I don't want to get you in trouble.
I'm supposed to have this phone call. I don't know why he's calling in.
Careful, you are on the record.
Yeah, is this being recorded? I don't want to get subpoenaed at a later date to say that you hung up on him. Amy,
no, I didn't even answer it. So,
Can you talk about where, once you got to BB&T, where your position fell, I guess, in the structure of that office or overall at BB&T in terms of corporate investigations?
In terms of corporate investigations, I was at the bottom of the ladder, I guess, but which we had other people who did, like audits and things like that, but they were in a different department. Which they did some of them did jobs that were similar to what I did, but they fell under a different, like I said, a different department or a different category or something at BB&T.
When you say you were at the bottom,
yeah, bottom.
Are you referring to yourself personally or corporate investigations overall?
No, I'm not referring to myself. I'm at the top as far as the investigators go. But as far as just like the hierarchy of the the structure within BB&T, I was at the bottom. There were, because I had a manager, and then that manager had a manager, and that manager had a manager. I did not supervise anyone, is what I mean.
Okay. Where would you say corporate investigations fell in the hierarchy, just as a division or department?
It was pretty, it was a respected department. I don't know exactly how you're looking at this, but, I mean, we took priority over over a lot of other departments. Whenever we came in, people knew, okay, you know, this is serious. They mean business. We're going to cooperate. I don't know how else to describe it. It was just people. It was a respected department within BB&T.
Now, when you say they took priority over other departments, can you be more specific in terms of, like, if you guys came in for a fraud investigation, could you be overruled by a sales associate? Could you be overruled by another department on what you found? Or was your
I guess occasionally we could. Yeah, you find what facts that you have in the investigation. You present whatever facts that you have to human relations. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to give you just a general idea, but I guess I wouldn't need a more specific case to refer to. But, you know, I guess if somebody had some kind of mitigating factors or something that they thought within another department that they thought, I guess, would override what facts were found in the case that we felt sort of led in one direction, I guess that it could be over, you know, they could override it. I would have to say that on a I would have to comment on a specific case and how it worked out, I guess. I don't know exactly how to answer your question there.
Okay. Now, your duties when you got there, going back to your specific job, were you just a fraud investigator, or were you handling embezzlement or employee screening?
No employee screening, but I would work cases that it's a wide range of cases that the investigators were assigned whenever I first started, and you may work a case where a suspicious person came into a bank, and you just try to pull the video and sort of see what can be resolved there, and you may work a case where you have an irate customer, and it may be a case as simple as that to a case as serious as we had a customer shot at one of the ATMs, or bank robberies, or, you know, violent crimes such as that, and we might work cases that was as little as, you know, a couple hundred dollars all the way up to millions. I mean, it just ran the entire gamut.
So the cases you were working there, I mean, the fraud loss and the dollar loss could be substantially higher than what you were working as a detective, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm, yes.
Now, would you say that as part of your job you had a liaison responsibility with local law enforcement, state law enforcement, and federal law enforcement?
Yes. Yes.
Was that delineated as part of your job duties?
Yes. Yes, I was supposed to keep very good contacts with the law enforcement agencies, and I did. I mean, you know, you just get cases and you work certain cases and you learn the people that will, you know, take on these cases, and you have people that have interests in certain type of case that you're working. You know who to call, and you know, you take these people out to lunch, and you just try to keep a very good relationship with local, state, and federal law enforcement.
Would you say you had a fairly good working relationship with federal law enforcement?
I would say yes.
Now, obviously the Bureau, I saw in your whistleblower or your Department of Labor complaint that you had some contact with the Secret Service. Did you work with any other agencies besides those?
Let's see, I worked with the Postal Service frequently because of mail fraud and things
right.
of that nature. Then I worked with the State Bureau on a couple of cases. I worked with, I'm trying to think of just the federal departments. I even had an occasion to work with the Canadian police. and I don't know. I mean, I can't The.
Did you ever work with any smaller, like, Office of Inspector Generals? HUD or Social Security or.
I didn't have any occasion to work with HUD. I did make some contacts with HUD because, you know, you never know when you may need them or when they may call upon you. So
right.
I had some contacts with HUD, not with Social Security. I don't think I had ever contacted them.
Okay. Amy, let's kind of jump into the Village of Penland case, which is where your civil case and the DOL complaint came from.
Mm-hmm.
Did we lose somebody?
Yes, me. Sorry, John Eugenis.
That's okay, John. How long were you working at BB&T before the Village of Penland case arose?
A year and a half, I guess, somewhere around there.
Had you worked a mortgage fraud type case before that?
I just can't recall any specifics right now, specifically any, but I'm sure that I did. I just can't recall any right off.
Up until that point, had you been fairly successful in your job as a corporate investigator?
Yes, very successful. I would say that I was the best corporate investigator that BB&T had.
George,
I recovered more money. I prevented more losses. And just closed a lot of cases and had a lot of good law enforcement contacts, and they were... I would try to have everything together before I turned over to law enforcement. So they were very accepting. Whenever I tried to present a case to them, they were really eager to take my cases because I had everything in order. All that they really needed to do was maybe very little legwork or make an arrest right away because I had mm-hmm. everything in order for them.
Okay.
George,
John,
if I add, yes, you will get documentation which was prepared for the head of corporate investigation before Dan Hill took over that position.
Okay.
And this individual liked to look at various benchmarks for the performance of his investigators. And you'll see that Amy performs extremely well in those benchmarks when those benchmarks were being published. So we have copies of that, and then you'll see it in her performance evaluations, which will also turn over how successful she is rated in performance of her job. So, you know, I want you to know that there's objective material to support what Amy's telling you now about her success rate.
Okay.
No,
it's fine. How many other investigators were there in your office, Amy?
Just one that worked out of the same office that I did, and that was George Wilson.
And about how many, I guess, if you know, how many in the state of North Carolina approximately?
I think 7 or 8 that were the same level as me, just a corporate investigator.
Okay. What happened with George Wilson? Was he involved in any way in the Village of Penland case?
He assisted me. I went and actually visited the site, and the first time I went out to the site, George actually rode with me out there. And whenever I searched the office of Brian Drum, George assisted me in that. And he was aware of the case because I talked about it a lot. It was a big case for me, and I discussed it a lot with him.
Okay, but it doesn't sound like he had any major involvement in the case.
No. It was my case.
Okay.
Amy, did you have any negative experiences prior to the Village of Penland case at BB&T?
Sure. Yes.
Can you describe those?
Let's see. I just had incidents where the regional management would sort of, butt heads with what the facts and things that I had found in the case. They would dispute those or try to, whenever, you know, cases that would clearly be, I felt like I was being hindered by the regional management that I had, the area of the North Carolina that I worked. I worked Charlotte Metro and the Western Region of North Carolina. Western Region was primarily mine, but anything that was more than what George can handle in the Charlotte Metro Region, I sort of got that overflow, because he actually got more cases assigned to him just in the Charlotte Metro Region than if I just worked. So I had to help him with some of those cases so that it would be equal in the amount of work that we had.
In what way were you hindered?
Just, let's see, for instance, I had contacted the police in Shelby on a case of embezzlement, and I told the officer, they had already made the decision that they were going to terminate the two employees. Mm-hmm. I told the detective that these two employees were going to be terminated on, I think it was like a, I thought that if they were going, I didn't know when they were going to be terminated, but I knew that the decision had already been made to terminate them and that he should go out and interview them right away, because they weren't aware that they were going to be terminated.
Okay.
And as long as they didn't know they were going to be terminated, that might give them more incentive to speak with the detective. I asked the detective to go out and speak. He did. He made I didn't ask him to go out. I just said, look, they're going to be terminated. You know, you might want to do your interviews pretty soon because the decision's already been made. He went out, and then he was turned away by the regional manager, Charlie Maddox, and Charlie told him that he could not come to the branch unannounced, that these employees had a job to do, and that he needed to make arrangements with the manager at the branch before coming out and doing interviews, that he had to schedule a time with the manager. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is Charlie Maddox, is he your corporate investigative supervisor?
No, he was the regional operations audit manager for the Western Region of North Carolina at that time.
I'm sorry, was it regional operations?
Audit manager.
Audit manager.
I think that's correct.
So he didn't want the PD coming out to the house to the branch. The branch to interview him.
Right, because he says they're busy, they're working. You know, they don't need to be interrupted. Then the officer's going to, or the detective's going to have to make arrangements with the manager of the branch on a time that would be suitable, and that, you know, maybe it's slower or something like that. A time that's slower. They don't have many customers in there to interview these two employees that are going to be terminated anyway. Like I said, the decision had already been made to do that.
Was Charlie Maddox aware that they were going to be terminated?
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Now then, but my argument with the entire thing was, when BB&T starts contacting the detective and saying, look, this is the date, this is the time that you can interview these employees, then they have actually became an agent for that department.
And right.
I just saw it as being a big liability for BB&T to start scheduling appointments, and it would make BB&T look like they were forcing their employees to cooperate with police investigations. So anyway, that became one of the arguments, and then later on, Charlie had called me back and said, hey, you can call up your detective now and tell him that he can interview these people. It was like a couple of days later, whenever when he had actually went out. And I said, Charlie, I can't tell this detective when he can interview and when he can't. I mean, he's got other things to do besides running out whenever I snap my fingers. You know, he's got to do it on his own time. So that was one of the arguments that we had, then another occasion, I had filed a report with a police agency on another embezzlement, And I reported it with the agency. Then Charlie comes back and says, look, we don't want to pursue any criminal charges in this. Just tell them you don't want to, that, you know, you, we don't want to cooperate in the investigation and just close the case. So I called the detective back and told him, look, we don't want to cooperate in this. We want to close the case. But then whenever I talked to my manager said, oh, no, you can't. Charlie doesn't have the authority to tell us what and what not to do and tell that detective that we do want to pursue the case and we don't want to close the investigation. So I had to call this guy back and just basically beg him to take our case on again and just things like that. It was just real embarrassing. I had a lot of conflicts with what I was supposed to do within the department of the corporate investigations department, and then conflicts with what the region actually wanted me to do. And I didn't work for Charlie. Understand that I didn't work under him, but I did work. The way it was described to me was Charlie is. We're supposed to look at our region as if they are our client. We want to make them happy.
But structurally speaking, Charlie Maddox was not above your supervisor in corporate investigations, was he?
No. He was totally separate.
Did he have, even if he was totally separate, did he have any authority to call off a corporate investigation?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It was like, I mean, I don't know. I would, of course, go to my manager and talk to him about it, but the way it was described to me is we have to work, we have to have a good working relationship with the region. And even though we don't work directly under the people in the region, we work for the region. It's as if they are our client, that we are the corporate investigations and needs to keep them happy, needs to do work for them like they're our client, like we're working for them. We're servicing them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, what was Mr. Maddox's compensation structure? And what I'm getting to, as you can probably figure out, is was he being compensated based upon the production of the region, and did he see you as being a potential threat to his increased compensation?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because he's looking at you know, the region being successful and him being successful within that region and making money and that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And one thing about Charlie was too, he hated because a lot of these things would be printed in the paper. Like if I filed a report, that becomes public record, and then the newspaper might pick up on it, and it would be printed in the paper, and he would see that as being damaging to the bank and his region, and he had complained about that frequently.
Okay, so he was trying to manage the PR, it sounds like.
Some of it was that. Yeah, definitely. Some of it was just the PR aspect of it, and I mean, I know that he had a, you know, he wanted the region to be successful and make money.
Getting into the mortgage sector of things, in your time there, I guess prior to the Village of Penland case, did you ever hear or did you ever witness fraudulent loans being funded despite maybe being flagged as potentially fraudulent or definitely fraudulent?
No, I don't think so. I can't recall of any incident where that the bank was aware that they were funding fraudulent loans. I cannot think of any. We had one loan where somebody had. I remember one loan case where I can't remember if it was the man or the wife, one of them signed the other one's name to the document, and then not anything. And the lender was aware that the wife or the husband had signed the name and continued on with the loan process and things, but nothing like the Village of Pentland, no.
Okay, because we've talked to some people in other businesses that have said, whether it was an underwriter or a fraud analyst, investigator, or what have you, that loans that had been flagged by quality assurance or underwriting as being potentially fraudulent were being funded anyways. You never saw any of that happen?
I don't know of any prior to the Village of Pentland.
The Village of Pentland. Okay.
Okay. Now, would you have been in a position to see loan files coming through the system that would be flagged on a regular basis for, let's say, a follow-up review, missing documents, potentially fraudulent activity? Would you be in a position to actually see those types of loans coming through the system on a regular basis? Okay.
No.
Okay. Who would have been the key individuals that you're aware of that would have been in those positions?
That would have probably been Dan Loftus. That was the portfolio manager. They've actually got people who look at loan documents like that, and analysts and things for direct retail lending. That would probably be because there are reports filed each day that are generated for loans and that have certain things flagged, I guess, on those
reports. Where would you get your cases referred to you from? I mean, what were the main channels that you would get where you would get cases from?
The majority of my cases came on my workbench. People at a branch, any person at BB&T can file a suspicious incident report. That's what they call it. So you just get you can just go to the site where the form is on the computer at any BB&T location, and you know, just fill in the blanks and send it in, and then it is sent to the, I guess, I don't know, the first review for SIR, and it reports. Then those are sent to the managers, and then the managers assign those. But I did get reports or investigations where somebody would just call me on the phone or, different ways like that. Or just different ways, but primarily they would be assigned by my manager to my workbench.
Amy, Jeff, why don't you?
Amy, related to the suspicious incident reports, I wanted to follow up with the question of whether or not those SIRs were created as the basis for future SARs that were actually created by other individuals in management within the organization. Is that how it worked?
Yes.
Okay.
So the suspicious incident report was actually a basis for the suspicious activity report.
It could be. Some suspicious incident reports would just end as a suspicious incident report. If the information in that report met the criteria to be filed as a SAR, then we would go ahead and file it as a SAR. The majority of cases that we got did not meet the criteria to be filed as SARs. Because the money amount it wasn't even related to the criteria that would be needed to file a SAR.
Now, could you file a SAR without filing a suspicious incident report?
No, we always filed a suspicious incident report.
So for every SAR filed by BB&T, there should be
a SAR.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, was that company policy to file the SIR first and then the investigation and then filing the SAR?
You know, I don't know if it's company policy. I guess you could file a SAR without filing a SIR, but I do not know of any incident that a SAR was filed without having a SIR prior to it being filed. I guess it's possible that somebody could, and I don't know if there's any policy to that makes it go in that process, you know, along those lines of process, but I don't know of any incident that a SIR was not filed prior.
Amy, can you comment on the process of filing SARs from the beginning to the end, kind of what that entailed?
How to file a SAR?
Well, I'm assuming that at different institutions, there's a different method. We've talked to some people that there was review process, and not necessarily, like, the teller who encounters a suspicious activity doesn't file a SAR. They, you know, flag a loan or a transaction as being probably fraudulent. It goes to fraud investigations. They take a look at it, and then fraud investigations kicks it to another level, who kicks it to another level, and then, you know, four or five steps down the line, the SAR finally gets filed.
Right. Yeah. That's similar to what we did. Let's say, for instance, something suspicious happens in the branch.
Can we tailor it to mortgages specifically? Because that's kind of our area that we're looking at.
Okay. Well, there's something wrong with some sort of loan documentation, or something's not correct with the loan documentation. Whoever would find that, they can either file a suspicious incident report themselves, or go to someone that knows how or has more knowledge, go to a manager and have a suspicious incident report filed, and then it would go to the SIR Center, a review area, and from there it would be...
Was that region or was that national?
That was... There's a specific area, and I think it's in Wilson. The department's in Wilson, North Carolina, I believe. And they would handle all of BB&T's SIRs. They go to that one department, all of them. And they could fax the employees can fax it in, or they can email it.
Was there
go ahead. Or you can actually call the SIR Information Center, and you can just tell them what's going on, and they'll key it in for you.
Was there like an online submission, like some sort of internal proprietary program to file the SIR, and you hit send, and it automatically
Yes, and it automatically go to the SIR Information Center or whatever it's called. I can't remember exactly what it's called. Then from there, they would divide up the send out the reports or whatever per to the regions. Like if something was suspicious in Florida, then they would send it to the manager over the investigators in Florida. And then, you know, if something happened in the Western region, then it would go to my manager, and then he would assign it to me, and it would show up on my workbench, the SIR. So I would actually open up my workbench on my computer, click on the case number or the case and then this case file would open up, and it has several pages of information, like suspect's information, witness information, you know, a synopsis of what had happened and that type of thing. Then from there, I would work the case and make a decision whether or not it met the criteria to have a SAR filed. If it did meet that criteria, I would type up my SAR on like Word or WordPerfect or some other kind of word processing software, and then transfer it to... No, I would send it to my manager. Then he would review it. Then we would cut and paste it, I guess, to the SAR document, and then it would go through a review. They just recently did that to where, because they would change the process a lot, but then we could send it to the SAR Information Center, and they were the ones that actually would file the SARs.
So BB&T had a SAR center that filed the SARs?
Yes, they're the ones that actually, I guess, hit the send button and filed it.
So there could be a considerable lag time from when, especially for a loan where the activity gets flagged as being having something wrong with it. It goes to the SIR center, to the regional, to your desk. Then you do your investigation, and then it goes, you know, you type it up, it goes to the manager,
mm-hmm.
your manager reviews it, then it gets sent to the SAR center.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a tracking process for this so you could see whether the SAR that you sent to, I guess, whatever BB&T branch that is responsible for filing SAR with FinCEN, to track whether that actually got sent?
I think that you could look it up on the ICMS, it's called the ICMS system. It's a, let me see, what is it? Investigations Case Management System. And actually see when it was the date that it was sent. I think that, like I say, it's been a long time since I've worked there, so I can't remember
everything.
But I think that you can find it in a specific date that it was sent, yes.
Do you recall any instances or instance where you went through the process, you took in the SIR, you investigated it, you go through the review process, you actually file the SAR with BB&T SAR Center, and that didn't get sent off?
No.
How often did you follow up on those SIR and SAR reports?
I'm not sure what you're meaning by that.
In other words, how often
did I check to see if they would actually be sent?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
Probably not often. I guess I just trusted that they would be.
Right. I don't mean to push you on this issue, but do you remember any specific instance where you actually did that?
Go back and check to see if it had been filed?
Yes.
No, I can't remember any specific incident, but I'm sure that I probably have on some to make sure that they were filed timely because, you know, you only have a certain amount of time to file them.
What was the lag time between the incident report being filed to when the SAR, I mean, typical, not specific to one case, but just a general ballpark?
They wanted it done, I think, now I'm not 100% on this, but I want to say that they wanted it done within 30 days. I can't remember specifically that that's it.
Approximately, like, how many of these would you get in a week?
How many reports?
Yeah.
You know, it would vary. I don't know. I couldn't even give you an average right off.
I mean, was it uncommon to come in and find 10 of these in your inbox from your supervisor on a Monday or a Tuesday?
No, that wouldn't be uncommon.
More than that?
I mean, you could get more. I wouldn't say more than 10, maybe coming in on Monday morning. I don't know. I can't answer that. I'm sorry. I will tell you this. When on my workbench, it was my goal to keep 10 or less cases on my workbench at any time. So I would, because once you get more than 10 cases, they start running together and you just get sort of overwhelmed with everything. So I would really try to do a good job of keeping up with the cases and keeping them down to where and following up on them right away so that I could keep that number down, because I would get confused and just get overwhelmed by having too many cases on my workbench, where when a lot of other people could possibly have 100-plus cases on their workbench at any time. And most people kept probably 50, right around 50 or so on their workbench. But that, I couldn't keep up with what I was doing if I had that many cases on my workbench.
Were the people who had 50, were they effective investigators? Because that sounds like a lot. I mean, I know
yeah,
on my
yeah.
end if I was...
I mean, I would say that they... probably not as effective as me. I don't know. I mean, probably not so much, because that's hard to keep up with what's going on, that many cases.
Amy, do you think you had adequate resources to do your job at BB&T as a fraud investigator?
Yes.
How was your, compared to other employees and I guess other business channels, do you think your pay was comparable or were you paid considerably less?
I think it was comparable. There were other investigators at other banks that made more, but there were investigators at other banks that made less, so I think it was, I thought that it was, I made less than probably most of the other investigators, but.
Why, at BB&T?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Why was that?
Just because, I just took the first offer that they made me, to start employment, because it was just a big jump for me. I just thought, well, hey, that's a good deal for me. But then, like George, for instance, he came in with some experience from SLED, and he was able to negotiate his pay better than what I could, and so he made more money than I did. Even though I did a lot better job than George, he made more money. I mean, that's just how it works sometimes.
Now, what about compared to, like, sales associates? Was your pay comparable or was it less?
To a sales associate?
Like
I'm not certain what they would make.
A loan officer, loan processor.
Just like a retail loan officer, something like that. I probably made more.
Now, what about with other types of compensation? I'm assuming you were straight salary.
Yes, it may be equal then. It may have been equal, but like a manager of a branch or something, they're going to make. I think they would make more money than me.
Do you think the way the I guess corporate investigation was structured at BB&T. Do you think that helped fraud investigations or hindered fraud investigations?
I don't know what you mean.
Like
how it's structured.
Structurally, like the way you were set up, your reporting structure, who could overrule you, basically, who could squash investigation versus who couldn't. I mean, do you think it was set up, the way it was set up, helped you guys or really kind of hindered what you guys were doing in fraud investigations?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that really. I think that the idea of how it was set up is good, but then whenever you do have people in the region who can sort of override what you say and override what the obvious facts are in the case, because this person is a high producer, that's wrong, and that's not a good setup. But ideally, the way that it's supposed to be, or how you think that it's going to be ran, or how they talk about it being ran, it should be a good process, I guess.
Amy, did you have any dealings with, or do you know anyone who did have any contacts with, like, a federal regulating agency? And by that, I mean, the FDIC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Office of Thrift Supervision.
Do I know if anybody that had contact with these people?
Was it regular to have contact with them or not really?
I never contacted the FDIC.
Or any other regulating agency?
No, I never contacted anyone, any of those personally, no.
Do you know anyone who did?
I can't think of anybody right off. And I thought that maybe the SIR, SAR Information Center, probably had those more contacts with those departments.
So I'm guessing if you never had any contact with them, that you don't recall any enforcement action by them either.
No, I don't.
All right, Amy, let's kind of delve into the Village of Penland case. How was that uncovered? Like, was it from a SIR, or was it?
No, I'm the one that actually had the SIR filed. This was a case where an incident that I worked out of the Shelby branch a lot because it was closer to my home and just used it as more of a, I guess, a little satellite office. And I was approached by a retail loan officer named Mike Smith, who had noticed some or found some suspicious activity with the loans that his manager, the bank manager at that branch, was involved in. So he said, "Hey, I need to talk to you."
Sorry to interrupt you. What was the name of that manager?
Brian Drum.
Okay.
Oh, so Brian Drum was the man. Okay.
He said, then Mike Smith just came to me and said, "Hey, Amy, when you have a minute, there's something I want to discuss with you, you know, just sort of run it by you and see what you think." And at that time, he pretty much knew that it was pretty serious, I think. And that was in February of 2007.
Now, how did he characterize what Drum was involved in? Was it odd, weird? Did he actually use the word fraud?
After I made a few phone calls and had an opportunity to sit down in his office, he said, "This is going to be the biggest." This is how he expressed it to me. "This is going to be the biggest case you've ever worked." So he knew that there was something up with it. He just said, "You know, this is the biggest case you will ever work." He knew that it was big. He thought that it was a huge case. He thought that he knew that it was serious at that time, whenever I sat down in his office for the very first time.
Did you notify your manager right away about this?
I didn't know what I had. I mean, I knew that it was a fraud, but I didn't, you know, I'm like, where's the, you know, I'm thinking to myself, where's the money going? What are they doing? And so it was actually maybe 2 days later or a couple days later or something. No, actually, I don't know if I called him. I don't know. It was probably a couple days later.
What was his reaction?
He felt that it was very, very suspicious, very interesting, and we were having a investigators conference near Winston-Salem, and he said, "Hey, we've got two speakers that are going to be talking about loan frauds. They work, the two people that work for BNT, and they were going to just go over, you know, some suspicious red flags to look for with loan fraud and just sort of give a quick overview, like loan fraud 101, I guess, for the investigators." And he said,
Amy, who was your supervisor at that
Brian,
time?
Brian Prater.
Can you spell that for me?
B-R-I-A-N Prater, P-R-A-T-E-R.
Thank you.
He said, "Just, hey, present this to these two people. The two speakers were Janet Scott and Craig Cobble. And they are, at that time, they were analysts with direct retail lending. So they would analyze fraudulent loans and try to pick up on red flags and things like that. That was their job."
Now, when you say direct retail lending, was that a channel within BB&T?
Yes. gave the information, or I sort of just jotted down on a piece of notebook paper. They were going over it, and during a break, I stopped Janet Scott and said, "Hey, look, I've got this is what's going on. You know, this company or this entity that is selling lots in Spruce Pine, they're making the payments for the clients. The photographs that are being used to represent one lot has already been used to represent, you know, other lots. The closing attorney is also the surveyor, and he is also involved with this group that's selling the property. Just there was a lot of red flags to all this. The people who were buying the lots were from Florida and Texas, and the lots were really small in size, and just there was a lot of red flags. I just sort of jotted them down on like a little piece of notebook paper and gave them to her, and she said, "Oh yeah, you know, this definitely sounds strange." And the thing that stood out to her the most was the fact that they were making a lot of the payments were being made through a Peerless account that they had set up. So, like, for instance, if you buy a piece of property from someone, from this group, they may be making the payments for you, which is crazy.
And how are they making their money on this deal if people, either knowingly or not knowingly, are buying little tiny lots in a basically unbuilt strip of land?
Uh-huh.
How are they getting their money out of it if the money's coming out of the Peerless account?
It wasn't on all of them. Some people were making their own payments, but some people were not. And to avoid having those accounts flagged, they knew somehow they knew that if it was like 30 days, that it wouldn't send a flag to some. To another group of people that might analyze it, and they would only keep it up to a certain degree. Like if somebody was late, they might, you know, pay a certain amount to try to keep it from being alerted.
So people were actually making payments on these empty lots. Now, were they just siphoning the money out of the Peerless account to pay themselves?
The bad guys?
I mean, like the Brian Drum and the people he was working with at Peerless.
Now, Brian Drum worked for BB&T.
Right, but I'm saying he was the loan officer who was approving the deal, so I'm assuming he got paid somehow.
As far as I know, he only was paid through... Now, he may have been given cash through Peerless or the group. Or that's what I'll call them, Peerless, because they had so many different company names. There was over – they had – I don't know how many companies registered, but it was like 100 companies. It was about 300 companies in all registered through this but through the same – place, Peerless or Penland, the Penland group. So I'll just call them, y'all just call them Penland? Is that what y'all call them then? The Penland area?
What's that?
The Penland area? I mean, I don't know what else to call it. I mean, or Peerless maybe? That's what I'd call it, Peerless.
Okay.
But in any case, I've been forgot where I was going with this anyway. What was the question? I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, do you know how, or how they were getting paid? Were they just, you know, embezzling money out of the account, either through another account, like laundering it that way, or just straight up deducting it from the account?
The way they were getting paid was through the loan, they would have.
I apologize, I got dropped off the call.
Okay.
No, that's okay.
They were getting paid through the loans. I don't know how else to.
But I mean, that's where their money was coming from, was the people making these payments on these empty lots, correct?
Yeah. Well, I guess sort of. They would get. Let me see if I can try to explain how it would work. They would recruit someone from an area and tell them that they are getting a piece of property that's going to be in a gated community in Spruce Pine, North Carolina, and tell them, you know, you really don't have anything to lose in this. You can, we'll set you up through a bank, and we'll have the bank finance 80% of the loan, and we will finance the other 20% of the loan. But I don't think that there was no money actually exchanged there. I think what they were doing was just overpricing the lots, and that they were actually, when you know, financed for 100%. They would overprice what the value of the lot was for. Then they were telling the customers or investors, I guess, you're making an investment here, and you'll get a 8% return on this, and we will, if for instance you do not want to keep this lot, or if you decide you don't want to build on it or whatever, then we'll buy the lot back from you. Well, the people were paying, you know, a lot of them were paying for their lots, but if someone were to get behind, or if something should, like for instance one of the investors died, they paid for his lot completely. And that was to keep any suspicion from coming on them from the lot not being paid for. So they were getting, and then it's a Ponzi scheme. They were getting all this money from these lot loans, but and the people were making the payments, but you know the money eventually runs out.
Did Peerless or whoever the development company was, did they actually own this land, or was it owned by somebody else?
It was, I want to say Tony Porter, is that his name, Tony Porter, Anthony Porter? I can't remember the name, I think that's it. Tony Porter had purchased it, and he was the actual owner of it, and then they went in and divided it up and was selling. I don't know what, it seems like, I can't remember right off, but it seems like I remember a certain amount that he actually paid for the entire tract.
George, George, I can provide you a lot of information about how the acquisitions occurred, from where they occurred, and then what ended up as the development itself.
Okay.
Including plot maps and what have you.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm sorry to interject. I just
no, went. Thank you. I don't know how to answer a lot of that. I get it.
Yeah.
Amy, why did you get so much opposition to your investigating this case when it seems like there was kind of I'll call it a blatant fraud? I mean, why did you get so much pushback?
Because the reason I got so much pushback was, I don't know, I'll see if I can. My managers wanted me to hold off some, so I didn't get pushback there, but I was sort of held back, I guess, more because they wanted to make sure everything was. My manager would say, look, whenever you go in, you cannot, and you've got a high performer, you've got somebody that makes a. That was one of the things I was trying to make a point with a while ago, is that Brian Drum, I didn't find any evidence that he was getting any kickbacks, but I did. He was considered a high performer, and he was getting you know, a lot of awards and things like that, and bonuses through BB&T for being the, what do you call it, the $1 million a month club or whatever. You know, he was getting bonuses through BB&T. I never did find any evidence of, you know, he may have gotten cash or something like that. I don't know. But, you know, I got, my manager would tell me to make sure you go in with a missile instead of a firecracker. You know, go in with a bomb instead of a firecracker so that the management cannot say, oh, we need to hold on to this person because they're a high producer or whatever. You know, just make sure you've got all your evidence and facts in order. So that was sort of what sort of slowed me down there, is just trying to get everything in order with everything. And then the pushback came really when they've, I think, it's, at first people weren't taking it serious, I don't think. I don't think anybody was just taking it serious because we hadn't lost any money at that time. We were still, you know, we hadn't, BB&T hasn't lost any money. And that was one of the things that Charlie Maddox asked me, was how much money have we lost? Well, at that time I said, you know, none. But, I mean, this is a significant fraud. But he says, well, since BB&T hasn't taken a, when BB&T hadn't taken a loss, nobody was taking it serious. When I sent my report to Dan Loftus, the portfolio manager, he sent it to his managers, and actually whenever they saw this, my report, that's when everything sort of kicked into high gear, and they said, oh my gosh, this is serious, why are we not doing something about this? And then once the attorneys were the attorney was hired and things like that, that's when I started getting a lot of pushback, because I was told not only is BB&T, because of my report, the way it was written, not only is BB&T going to be responsible for the $120 million that they loaned, but they're going to be responsible for the entire amount that was loaned by other banks, because Brian Drum stated that he was involved in developing the incentive program. Because somebody within BB&T is basically saying they're involved in this fraud, then that makes BB&T a responsible party for the entire fraud. That was one of the reasons why I got a lot of kickback. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I know I'm talking in circles and just, you know, just a lot of going a lot of different ways with this, but I'm really trying to keep it in order for you. It's tough.
Yeah, no, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Sorry, we're trying to compose our next question. You know, you said when the attorneys got involved, was that BB&T outside counsel Kilpatrick Stockton?
That was BB&T's outside counsel. I think it's Pitt, Bell, and Davis. Or Bell, Pitt, and Davis. Rennie
okay.
Pitt was the attorney.
Now, what was their, if it sounds like Dan Loftus and his supervisors were concerned that BB&T, while they hadn't taken a loss yet, could potentially take a huge loss.
Yeah.
What was outside counsel's problem? It sounds like once they came in, or at least according to you, when they came in, that's where the wheels kind of came off.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because Rennie Pitt read my report, and in the report, after I had to interview Brian Drum had told me that he was involved in developing the incentive program, in developing the program to sell these lots, basically. So he was involved in coming up with the process. So Rennie Pitt said that not only was BB&T responsible for what BB&T had loaned, but for what the other banks had loaned too, because they can say, you know, that Brian Drum was the one that helped, you know, was working as an agent, I guess, for the Village of Pentland. Does that answer your question?
Right. Right. So in essence, he helped to design the scheme, the fraud.
Right. He helped design the scheme or fraud.
Right. And then having it in a report could be potentially considered as some sort of admission.
Yes.
and could result at the end of the day in BB&T being hit for not only the damages related to its loans, but also the loans on the part of the other banks that were defrauded by the scheme, you know, to which BB&T allegedly or possibly could be seen as an aider and abettor.
Yes.
Something to that effect. Okay.
Right. And so Rennie did not want me to have any contact with the FBI from there on out. He said that he would handle any contact that with the FBI from that time on, that he asked me, did you give them a copy of your report? I told him no, that I hadn't given them any documentation, but I had filed a SAR. I had already filed a SAR at that point. And
right.
That's when he about had to come apart. He about had to come apart. He started put his head down in his hands and started moaning and stuff. And then I thought, my gosh, I've really screwed up. I've done something really wrong here. And so he said, we've got to get a copy of that. So Dan Hill has a copy of the SAR sent back to Rennie, has it faxed in real quick. And Rennie reads over it, and it's got some of the same language that the report, the report that I was going to give to the FBI had. And some of that was that Brian Drum said that he was involved in the incentive program. Well, Rennie says we've got to change this. We've got to recall this SAR. We've got to change it. And Dan Hill says, look, we can't. Once it's filed, it's filed. The only thing that we can do is update it and make what changes we want on an update. But we cannot take back this original document
right.
and change it. You know, it's already sent. It's already gone. It's out there. That's done. And so Rennie said, okay, that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to get this, have some kind of update filed that's going to try to mitigate that statement. So my manager, Brian Prater, filed an update to my original SAR stating that Brian Drum was not involved with developing the incentive program. He was just responsible for setting up a direct draft.
How did you feel when you saw that report? The updated report.
When I saw the updated report?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I thought, I'm thinking that I've done something wrong. I mean, they're sort of blaming all this on me, so I'm almost feeling guilty in a sense, I guess, because they're saying, okay, we're going to take a loss, and when we take a loss, it's going to be your fault now because of your report. I'm feeling kind of, I don't know, guilty in a sense.
Did you let the FBI, at that point, you had already contacted an FBI agent, correct?
Yeah, I had to contact the FBI very early on because I was going to see if he knew, you know, maybe where, if we could recover the money, maybe the money was being held somewhere, or, you know, if he had ever seen any kind of scam like this, that, you know, maybe he could point me in the right direction to sort of go with it.
Do you remember that agent's name?
Mike McNeely. That was the first one I spoke with. Then as time progressed, Mike got, he was on some other case, I can't remember, and whenever it came time for me to actually meet with him, he said, no, I'm not going to be able to meet with you. Contact this other agent, and his name was, I can't remember right now, Curry. I can't remember his name right now.
That's okay.
It may come to me in a minute.
Did you relay to the FBI that you or that your supervisor was told to amend or file, I guess, an amended SAR stating changing the facts?
Right. No, at that point, I was told not to have any contacts with the FBI, that if the FBI should contact me for any information, to refer them to Rennie Pitt's office, not to even speak to them at all. So, no, I didn't call them back and say anything.
Did they find that troubling, that you weren't returning their phone calls, that you basically dropped off the face of the earth?
No. What happened was whenever they presented the case to the FBI,
right.
They did not include my report. They just gave what information that Rennie Pitt and Dan Hill gave, what information they wanted the FBI to have. They didn't give them my report. They didn't give them any of the documentation related to, like, the brochures with the Village of Penland. They didn't give them, like, Brian Drum's handwritten notes that I had recovered. They didn't give them witness, because I had taken a bunch of witness statements from people that worked with BB&T that sort of knew something was going on, but they were afraid to come forward with it. So I'd taken a lot of witness statements. They didn't turn any of those over to the FBI. Now, what I was told to do was whenever we have our meeting with the FBI, because it was at my office, I had already scheduled it sometime before, and it was supposed to be at my office, and they told me whenever the FBI comes in, you just introduce us to the FBI and then excuse yourself, say that you got something else to do. So that's what I did. Whenever the FBI came in, I introduced everybody and I excused myself. They presented the information to the FBI. I'm sorry.
Just to go back to something that I read in some of the documents we have. Is it true that they specifically told you that they didn't want you at those meetings because they were pretty sure that if you got asked a question by the FBI that you would answer it?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Yes, Rennie Pitt told me that. That's what Rennie Pitt told me. We don't want you in a meeting with the FBI. Because we're afraid that if they ask you a question, you'll answer them. Which I don't know to tell anything, but you know, I wouldn't even begin to know how to lie about any of it.
Did Mike McNeely or the people from the FBI question, especially since you had alerted them early on, why? And I'm assuming they knew what investigative steps you had taken to that point. Why none of your investigative material was part of that presentation?
I don't think that they did question that. I don't think so. Now, later, after I was terminated, I went and spoke to the FBI, and at that time they said, we thought it was strange that you did not present the material to us, but, you know, they thought, I guess they just really didn't question it any further. They just thought that it was odd or strange and really didn't go into why, just thought, well, that's kind of unusual. They thought that it was unusual, but just didn't go into trying to dig and find out why I didn't present the information to them. But they did tell me that they thought that it was, they definitely thought that it was strange.
Amy, in your Department of Labor complaint, you mentioned that you had, I guess, off the cuff presented this case to a Secret Service agent, I'm assuming in the Charlotte office.
Yeah.
Do you remember who that was?
Bruce Frame.
Bruce Frame?
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce said if the Bureau didn't take it, they would take a look at it?
Yeah, he said, you know, that sounds very interesting because at the time, the first time I talked to the FBI, we knew that it was, what was it, $120 million. But then the second time I talked to the FBI, I was like, look, this is bigger than that. You know, not only with BB&T, it's $120 million, but with the other banks, it's a lot more. Yeah, it's a lot more money. So, you know, I was talking to Bruce about it just to sort of see if he had experienced anything like this too, and he hadn't, and sort of ran it down with him. He said, look, you know, if the FBI decides they don't want to work that case and you need to refer it to somebody, I'll take it. I'd be more than glad to work it for you.
Has anybody looked into the fact that the SAR was updated and was updated using a material misstatement of fact?
I remember the guy's name, Doug Curran. Doug Curran was the FBI agent.
In connection with the Department of Labor complaint that
I'm sorry,
John. You're going in and out.
Are you there, John? John? John, I'm sorry. We can't hear what you're saying. I think your cell phone is cutting out.
Is it better?
Yeah. Perfect. Sorry. We couldn't hear anything that you said. What were you saying?
Okay. The SAR issue is extremely sensitive because of the Banking Secrecy Act, and in connection with the pending or the Department of Labor case, as well as a U.S. District Court case, which was its companion, there was an order not to talk about that. Now, that was different from what, of course, we, you know, was given to the FBI, because the FBI was interviewing her, and she has an obligation as a to, you know, be truthful, and she did, and she responded to every question. But the issue of the SARS was outside of those two cases, and then, of course, there was a pending case between the FDIC and BB&T about the SAR, which we don't have any information about. That was, that case was conducted, which I think is now before the Fourth Circuit, totally under protective order, under seal. The only time this issue came up was in a district court case. Was before the U.S. magistrate in the case in Asheville, in which it was attributed to Amy that she had filed an amended SAR, and I informed the court that that was not accurate, that she had not done that because she had been terminated already when that SAR was updated, and yet her name was subscribed as being the reporting person. So,
John, was there a corresponding U.S. District Court case, I guess, for the fraud? Oh, did the FBI eventually pick this up and run with it?
Well, you know, there have been at least five criminal investigations resulting in informations and pleas of guilty by the principals that were involved with Village of Pentland.
Was Brian Drum one of them?
No, okay. No, it was Tony Porter, Skip Amelung,
Randy Carpenter.
Well, that one has, I don't know where that one is. He hasn't, as far as I know, all he's lost is his license. God, I can't think of the other individuals.
Neil O'Rourke.
Neil O'Rourke, who had been a partner at a very large law.
Let me rephrase. Were any BB&T employees ever plead to an information or indictment?
No. Nor are we aware of any investigation. I mean, that's not something that we kind of have been
shared. And as far as you know, Pitt is not under investigation, correct?
Again, that's not something that has been shared with us one way or the other.
Okay.
Again, Amy's given at least two statements to the FBI, where Doug Curran was.
Right. Were these homes ever built?
No. There is one log cabin that was built for one of the Amelungs, who was two brothers who were two of the three principals involved as owners of the development. But there was no house ever constructed.
Were they prosecuted?
Skip pled guilty. Tony Porter was, and he pled guilty, to information. I don't know if Skip's brother was.
So, how many acres are we talking in the villages of Pentland? I mean, are we talking 20 acres or a couple hundred acres?
No, it's roughly, what, Amy, 1,400 acres with subdivided into about 2,000 lots?
I can't remember. I mean,
something of
I
that nature, but
that.
I have the plat map, I have all that information documented.
So in roughly approximately 2,000 lots on 1,400 acres, there's only one log cabin sitting on all of it?
Yeah, the only other structure that was ever built was a stable for, mini horses that, you know, they eventually tore down because of shoddy construction. Now, what you will see the improvement is a masonry block wall around a dried lake bed that was fed by a stream that they had diverted, and the federal and state agencies in charge with those issues closed that down and then they have gravel roads and some signage, but no improvements, no utilities were ever brought onto the property.
Is this forest land, or is this like just open prairie land we're talking about?
No, it's heavily mountained, hilly. Every little flat land, and I will send you a video that we made. It at one time was I think cut of the hardwood trees, and what remains in large part are all softwoods. And I can't tell you what hardwood trees were removed. And I think it was removed before the developer ever bought the property. But everything is, you know, there are very hilly.
And they were going to put they were going to put 1,400 homes on all these hills.
Well, what's interesting is if you go out there, you have to remember what the cost of the lots were. So, in order to justify a lot sale at that amount, you'd have to have a pretty expensive home. And then when you go out there and you realize the topography is such that, you know, it's extremely hilly, you'd wonder, well, how could they ever build a home? Because it would not fit within the topography. If you look at the plat map looks like somebody laid this thing flat and drew, you know, nice square or shaped lots, but that's not that doesn't fit the land when you go out and look at it because of its topography. And I think the argument that we've consistently made is that anybody who knew anything about land development could go out there and say, this wouldn't work. You couldn't possibly build homes on this to justify a home on these small lots.
Were they all going to be septic, or were they going to be county?
All
or?
They would all be septic.
They would have to be because they tried to get a sewer. They attempted to get like a sewer system brought in, but
I'm assuming they were all going to be septic and well, and no
yes.
County water, no county sewer.
Yes.
Well, the water though, I think there is a water line that is stubbed at the property line.
Okay.
I think they did at least have that delivered by the local municipality.
Okay.
Just to go back to the issue of mortgage fraud, did you observe any similar attempts to quash investigative efforts on the part of BB&T related to any other mortgage-related cases?
I can't think of any right off.
Okay. Are you aware of anyone else that was at BB&T when you were there that you've spoken to that has had a similar experience to you?
Yes, that used to work there, and that would be Joseph Yoey. He was.
How do you spell that?
Josephyoehe.
Okay.
Joe Yoey, and he was let go from BB&T. I guess whenever they were downsizing, and he's had some experiences similar to mine. Up around the D.C. area and Virginia areas.
Was he in a similar position to you?
He was actually a regional manager, so he was a one level higher than me.
Okay. You wouldn't happen to have his contact information, would you?
Sure.
Okay. Would you mind sending that to us through your attorney?
I could probably give it to you now if John doesn't have any objections.
No, that's fine. I don't have a problem. And he testified at the trial.
Oh, he did. Okay.
This is the number I have for him. 703.
Okay.
625-9706.
Okay.
That's his mobile number.
Also, just to try to incorporate your complaints by reference, is there anything in your complaints that you have gone back to, looked at it after the fact, and don't quite agree with just from a strictly factual standpoint? In other words, can everything be incorporated as it's written exactly?
I can't think of anything that I would have changed. I don't have anything right off. No.
Okay. All right, that's all my questions.
Amy, I want to talk to you about your kind of the adverse reaction you got at BB&T. Once you brought up an encounter, you know, you said you brought in outside counsel brought in. What other, aside from not being told to talk to the FBI, aside from being told to amend your SAR, what other adverse experiences you have at BB&T I guess I'm trying to find a good phrase. I know there is one, but I guess detrimental conduct that you were subject to.
Well, I was transferred. I was told not to work out of the Shelby branch anymore. Brian Drum was still working at that branch at the time when I was told not to work out of the Shelby branch anymore, and I felt like that was just so that I couldn't dig or couldn't find any more information on him, and that was a decision that Charlie Maddox had made, that he did not want me working out that Shelby branch.
Was Brian Drum ever disciplined in any way? Was he ever transferred? Or
he was eventually terminated.
But during the course of this, you know, it sounds like they transferred you
right
to get you out of there. Did they put him on administrative leave, suspension, anything like that?
Originally it was decided that they would revoke his lending authority, that they would send him back through some additional training, and that he would be giving a written warning. That was initially what the punishment was for him.
I'm sorry. You know, they revoked his lending authority. If he's a loan officer, that kind of takes away his job. Was that just a temporary, like, you know, we'll suspend your lending
authority? Yeah, temporarily, until they can send him back through more training and that type of thing, yeah. Just temporarily revoke his loan authority until you know, he's able to be retrained and go through some additional training and maybe, I don't know how long that would take for to have his loan authority revoked, but that was
right.
That was the solution to it, until the information got to direct retail lending. Once that information got to them, they said, "Hey, this is a lot more serious than what y'all are making it out to be. This guy needs to be terminated." And that was when the decision for his termination was made. Was after direct retail lending had become involved in it.
I mean, were you ever threatened by anybody? Did Brian Drum ever kind of create a hostile work environment for you? Or any other managers above you in BB&T corporate structure?
My manager, it was never a hostile, I don't know, I guess it was hostile in a sense because I was Charlie Maddox filed a complaint on me saying that I had manipulated my report and had told lies basically on Brian Drum in an effort to have him terminated, and that I had manipulated my report to reflect badly on Brian Drum. So here I am in a position of working as a corporate investigator and having him accuse me of lying and manipulating the facts of my case, and I tried to express to my manager and the human relations manager that that's like accusing a firefighter of arson. You know, you just can't accuse a investigator of manipulating the facts and manipulating reports and being a liar in essence, because I'm working investigations. I've got to be truthful and honest in what I'm relaying. And I felt that was a very, very serious accusation. Then I had instances where Brian Drum thought, once he was fired, he tried to find another job. he was having a difficult time finding jobs because these employers were calling them other employees at BB&T, and these employees were telling them what had happened.
Right.
Well, Brian Drum thought it was me, that I was giving him bad references, which, I mean, nobody ever called me for a reference. And so then my manager calls me and says, you know, what's going on here? And but Brian Drum had made a complaint to Charlie Maddox and to Rennie Pitt about me. And then so my manager's contacting me trying to find out why I'm giving Brian Drum a bad reference. And I told him I wasn't. I haven't said anything to anybody about Brian Drum. But I said, look, I can find out who he is. Well, I find out that two other employees are the ones that are giving the bad references. They're jumping down my throat over giving Brian Drum bad references, and it wasn't me. Whenever I find out who the other two employees were that was giving the bad references, nothing was ever done to those two employees. So, I mean, it was just, at that point, it was like, try to find something on Amy. That's sort of how I felt at that point was, okay, they're trying to find something on me. They're trying to find something, you know, so that they can get rid of me. I definitely got that sense.
And you were eventually terminated for, I guess, not putting in leave to go qualify with your firearm?
The day that I was terminated, I was told that the reason that I was being terminated was because I had discussed Brian Drum's termination with another employee, and that was discussing an internal investigation, and that I did not have the authority to discuss employees' terminations. If the other employee that I had talked to had a question or something, they should have called human relations. They shouldn't have talked to me about it. That I had discussed an employee's termination, therefore I had discussed a internal investigation with someone I should not have. That's the reason.
And they fired you because of that?
Yes, that's why I was being terminated. And because I had went to the firing range the day before I went to the firing range, and I asked him, I said, does this have anything to do with me going to the firing range yesterday? He said, no, that was icing on the cake. And never once was that an issue until after they had to file a paperwork with the Employment Security Commission. That's whenever I realized that they were listing that as one of the reasons I was being fired. I even asked the day of my termination if that was one of the reasons, and I was told no. At the day of my termination, the only reason I was being fired was because I had discussed an employee's termination with another employee, and that was considered discussing an internal investigation. Therefore, my employment was being terminated.
Now, since the trial and everything, the civil trial was found in your favor, correct, John? I guess John.
Is he back off?
I don't think so.
John?
I guess, Amy, you can answer that.
Yes, the Labor Department hearing is a Labor Department case, and it was found in my favor. The judge did find it in my favor.
Was there a civil trial with your case as well?
There was a civil case, but that's been dropped now. But the only thing the only case that we had and where the hearing was the Labor Department hearing.
Okay, and that's the one you were on the stand for 2.5 days?
Yes.
Okay.
And you were actually, as a result of that, re-employed, is that correct?
Yes.
And so are you still working for BB&T?
No, I resigned at the end of May. I didn't actually go back to work for them. They didn't want me to come back and actually work.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. You left in May of 2010?
That would have been my last day, work actually being employed for them, yes.
And now you're back with the Sheriff's Department full-time?
Yes.
As a detective?
No, I'm just a regular road patrol officer.
Yeah, do you guys, are you the sole, is the county sheriff's office, is that the sole law enforcement entity for the county?
For the county, yes. I mean, we have highway patrol that works traffic, and but we don't have any other.
Okay, because, yeah, I know some, at least around here, some departments have, like, a county PD, and they also have a county sheriff's office.
Right, no, we are just one.
Okay. Amy, I don't think we have any more questions for you. Is there anything you think we should know for our investigation in the mortgage fraud that Jeff or I have not brought up today?
I mean, I don't know exactly. And what are y'all trying to get at? What are you trying to accomplish from this?
We're just trying to see, you know, obviously there was a mortgage fraud was fairly rampant in the early to mid part of the decade. And there is some evidence to suggest that that was part of the financial crisis. You know, obviously the housing market collapsed, but there is some evidence to suggest, and there are some various opinions out there that fraud was a large part of that.
Right.
Right. And the other part of it is there seems to be a significant lack of enforcement that occurred in the period leading up to the crisis, which may have contributed to a large number of bad loans being conducted, being done, which, of course, you know, found themselves fed into the securitized markets and spread throughout the world in the form of, CDOs, CDO squared, mortgage-backed securities, et cetera. And so it's important, you know, for us to look at what the various institutions were doing out there, such as BB&T, or not doing to prevent mortgage fraud from occurring and thereby adding to the toxic waste that ended up, throughout the system.
Right. I don't have anything else to tell you because I didn't have any other experience with a case like this with BB&T. But Joe Yoey, he could probably enlighten you to some other things. Because he was a manager too, and he would have more, he would have access to what all his investigators did and what they were doing at the time. So he would have, and the way he talks, it was something that was just going on. But I didn't see it. I didn't see that. That was the first experience that I had, and the only experience that I had with it.
But Joe Yoey said that this was quite common.
Yeah. Yes, he says it's common.
Yeah.
Just so we don't catch him off guard, I mean, do you still have regular contact with him?
Yeah, he definitely would not mind if you called.
Okay.
I can guarantee that.
If you could do us a favor when we get done, we're probably not going to do it today or tomorrow. If you could just call him and let him know that we'll be contacting him.
Okay.
In the near future. I'm going to be going on leave starting tomorrow, and I'll be gone until the 14th of July. Jeff's shaking his head right now. He's angry at me.
Jealous.
It's for a good cause.
Yeah, I'm getting married next Saturday, so
congratulations.
That's why I'm disappearing for quite some time. But if you could just call Mr. Yoey and let him know that we're probably going to reach out for him, and if he's local here in D.C., we'd like to interview him in person.
Okay.
And tell him not to be afraid. We're not looking at him for any sort of criminal conduct. That's not the focus of our investigation.
Oh, trust me, he's not afraid of that
okay,
at all.
Okay, yeah. Some people, when they mention interview, you mention, you know, that there's law enforcement going to be present, they get very hanked up. But this is friendly. We just like to know what he knows.
Yeah, he's a former law enforcement also.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
Oh, okay, perfect. Well, we greatly appreciate your time. I know John told me this is your day off today.
Yes.
Okay, well, it's speaking for someone who gets very few days off sometimes, I greatly appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I hope that I gave you some information that's going to be helpful. I don't know, but hopefully it was.
Yeah, and John, we appreciate your time as well, if you're still there.
Here.
Okay.
All right, okay. John. If you need to get a hold of me, or Amy, you need to get a hold of me, or Jeff, you guys have my email, my phone number. Don't hesitate to reach out.
We do.
All righty.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, guys.